Welcome, everyone, to Inspired by Math. In this podcast series, I interview people who are inspired by math and who are inspiring others. I'm really excited this morning to be interviewing Al Cuoco. He is co-author of this wonderful new book by the MAA, Mathematical Association of America, titled Learning Modern Algebra. And what caught my attention was the subtitle, From Early Attempts to Prove Fermat's Last Theorem. Welcome, Al.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
Yes, and I too am really excited to have you here, because if you've listened to some of my podcasts and if listeners have listened to others of my podcasts, you'll realize that I'm not somebody who reviews very many textbooks. I am much more interested in, you know, the inspiration of math and what gets people excited about math enough to, you know, dive into a book and work through it and play with it. But when I got this book from the MAA and looked through it, it was like there was something interesting and familiar that caught my attention that made me realize very quickly that this is not an ordinary math textbook. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do a podcast interview with the co-author of this textbook. So before I get it a little bit into your background, let me ask you, because I do not want to forget that Joseph Rotman is co-author of this book, but he wasn't able to be here with us. So can you say a little bit about him and his role in the book?
Sure. I mean, excuse me. We actually met maybe 15 years ago when I visited the University of Illinois, but then we sort of lost touch and reconnected again about 5 years ago at a conference at the University of Arizona on the mathematical preparation of teachers. And we started a discussion there about the role of abstract algebra and how it could be but isn't a useful tool for practicing teachers. You know, I've admired Joe's books for a long time. He's written really, really well-received books in group theory, Galois theory, abstract algebra, and so forth. So we started talking about what an algebra course tailored to pre-service and practicing teachers might look like, and how we could include applications that would be meaningful to the profession. And maybe a month or two later, he got in touch with me and said, "What do you think about writing a book for this kind of a audience?" And I said, "Well, sure, count me in." And so we began working together, basically, just writing chapters, trading drafts, doing phone calls maybe once or twice a week, arguing a lot, and gradually polishing the text. So it's been quite an experience, and I think we've both enjoyed it.
This is great. Very, very good. And let's see. You sent me a bio, and there's quite a bit of information in the bio, so I'm not going to read the whole thing, but something that struck me is that basically you are a curriculum guy, and you are also, as you said, you're into teaching teachers, but you're also, you've worked quite a bit for a number of years with high school students.
Right.
So it's like you're spanning all of these worlds. You're not just into curriculum. You're not just a math teacher. It's interesting that you're doing the three of them.
Right. Yes. I mean, I started out when I graduated college teaching high school. But I always wanted to, this was 1969, so it was quite a time. And so I had intended to go to graduate school, but didn't. Took some time to teach high school. And then went to a summer institute at Bowdoin, where they, NSF-sponsored institute for high school teachers, where I was exposed to some really wonderful mathematicians, Ken Ireland, John Lubin, A.W. Tucker, for 4 summers. And it made me decide to just bite the bullet and go back to graduate school. So I did that in 1976, I think. Went to the PhD program at Brandeis, and again met some just incredibly brilliant people that I've stayed in touch with for years. Ralph Greenberg was my advisor, Paul Monsky, and that's where I met Glenn Stevens. We'll talk a little bit about him when we talk about the Ross program. And then after the PhD, I decided to just go back and teach high school for another decade, and then thought about doing something different. So went to work at Education Development Center, which was then in Newton, Mass, basically to work with a guy I met a long time ago, Paul Goldenberg. And I've been there ever since, working with teachers, writing high school. We have a high school curriculum that's being used by 50,000 kids around the country, doing workshops for teachers, and working at this Boston University program that's a version of the Ross program.
Yes.
So that's essentially how I get into this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're definitely, absolutely, we will talk about the Ross program, because that's what I didn't realize when I picked up this book and started looking at it. There was something that caught my attention, and we will all see, and all of our listeners will get the connection. Right. So in your bio, it says that you are the lead author of CME Project, an NSF-funded high school curriculum published by Pearson. And
right.
Recently you served
as... That's the curriculum.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
That's the curriculum I just mentioned. Yeah, it's a four-year high school program that we've been working on for, close to 20 years now.
Very good. And it says that you are carrying out several professional development streams of work, devoted to the Common Core state standards for mathematics, right? You've talked about that. And you co-direct something called Focus on Mathematics, partnership among universities, school districts, and EDC that has established a community of mathematical practice involving mathematicians, teachers, and mathematics educators. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this grew out of the collaboration I've had with Glenn Stevens from BU. Why don't we just back up a bit and talk a little bit about the Ross program and how that evolved into Focus on Mathematics.
Let's do it. Go ahead. Perfect.
Okay. So, let's see. I met Glenn Stevens around mathematics, not around education, when he was visiting Brandeis's just as I was finishing up. But we stayed in touch, and this was in 1980 or so. And then in 1989, Glenn, who was an alumni of the Ross program at Ohio State, and so was Steve Rosenberg and David Fried, all at BU, and Maji Baruch at Syracuse, started in 1989 a version of the Ross program called PROMISE, Program in Mathematics for Young Scientists, at BU. And it's the same kind of thing. They use the same problem sets, although they edit them a little bit every year. And then a couple of years later, Glenn asked me if I'd be interested in bringing some teachers into the program. And it sounded like a great idea. I mean, just the idea of spending 6 weeks doing nothing but mathematics seemed like a perfect way to help teachers kind of experience what it's like to work as a mathematician. So we started that in 1991. It was very small. But it's been going on now since then. And it's between 35, 40, maybe 45 teachers every summer come to spend 6 weeks working through number theory problems all day long. In 2003, we decided to apply to the National Science Foundation for what they call a Math Science Partnership, an MSP, and we called it Focus on Mathematics. And that's been going on since 2003. It's a partnership between BU, EDC, the University of Massachusetts in Lowell, and seven school districts. And the basic idea was to build this community of mathematical practice among mathematicians, teachers, and educators. So, for example, the Promise for Teachers program is a central piece of that. Some of the teachers in the partnership come every summer to Promise, and some are now counselors in the program. But we also have mathematicians working with teachers after school in what we call study groups. They meet maybe twice a month after school for a couple hours, just to work on mathematics. It's something like a math circle, although it's much more driven by the interests of the teachers themselves. So Focus on Mathematics is sort of an ongoing partnership. The funding has ended, but we still keep running these study groups. We have an expo for high school kids to present their work, and seminars and colloquia, and of course, Promise for Teachers. So in a way, Promise for Teachers has turned into the centerpiece for this collaborative.
That is great, and as you said, that had its roots in the Ross program, which I attended for a couple of summers. I think it was 1979 and 1980, and
yep.
it was a remarkable program. I have to admit that I was, as a 16 or 17 year old, however old I was then, I was not very mature for the program. Looking back, I wish I had been more mature in my attitude towards mathematics, because math had always come easy to me, and I absolutely loved it. And then I got thrown into this program. I didn't know what I was in for. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, it was an 8-week program at Ohio State University. And Arnold Ross, when he was alive, he was, a brilliant mathematician. Certainly, he was a number theoretician, and I'm not sure what other branches of math he may have studied. But he would, so I think it was an 8-week program, 5 days a week. We would have the morning lecture with Professor Ross, and we studied number theory for those 8 weeks. He would lecture on what he would call the discovery method, and just brilliant in lecturing. And then we would have a problem set that we would spend the rest of the day pretty much working on. There would be 20 or 24 problems, handwritten, crammed into one side of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. And these were not easy.
Right. Well, that structure is essentially the same as what's going on at BU now in the summertime, except the audience is these very, very advanced high school kids and practicing teachers from around our partnership and around the state. But it's the same thing. Glenn gives the morning lecture, and he has this saying that he makes sure that nothing's covered in a lecture until people have struggled with it for 3 days. And then a problem set is handed out, and people go off. The teachers go off to a separate room from the kids and just do nothing but work on the problems all day long. Nobody finishes the problem set, or very few people finishes the problem set, and that's by design. They're looked over by counselors every night, handed back the next day. People revise their solutions, revise their approaches, and it goes on like that for 6 weeks. The teachers tell me that they feel like it's drinking from a fire hose.
And I imagine if these problem sets are at all like the problem sets we worked on, so many of the problems were open-ended. So it's not like multiple choice. It's not the kind of problem where if you're good at taking tests, you're going to do well, because you have to look for patterns. You have to, generalize from some data. You have to do what he called PODASIP, prove or disprove and salvage if possible. And I noticed that in your book. I was flipping through the pages the other day. I didn't see it when I first looked at your book, and you have some PODASIP problems.
That's right. That's right. And so the original problem sets themselves were just a brilliant piece of curriculum design. An idea would start out in numerical calculations and numerical experiments, and then later on generalize, and then after that generalize even further. And so there were these threads that you could trace right through the problem sets. And we tried to do this in the book as well, and we tried to do it in our high school curriculum, where we have this saying that experience precedes formality. So we give people the experience of experimenting with things and then moving on to more generalization and formalization. But the formalization is kind of the capstone, not the foundation. And so the PODASIPs are important because, in real life, you're usually not presented with something and say, prove this. You're presented with a statement, or you come up with a statement through an experiment, and you have to decide if it's true or false. And if it's false, you don't throw it away, you try to repair it. And so that's what this prove or disprove and salvage if possible idea is.
Yeah, it's an absolutely brilliant idea, and of course it makes the problem sets much more challenging, but also, as you said, it makes them more real world and more relevant, because it forces the student to engage with the problem.
Yeah, and I think it's a really valuable habit to build, that when you come up against a brick wall, when something doesn't seem to be working, you don't throw it away. You try to go back and add some hypotheses, or repair some of what you're doing and salvage it. Fermat's last theorem is a perfect example of that. It's probably the best example in the 20th century that, and modern mathematics, I'm sorry, that there were many attempts to prove it, and the proofs were gradually refined over the years, and they saw flaws in the proof, and they tried to repair those. So the original flaws had to do with a lack of unique factorization. They tried to restore that. That led to the whole theory of ideals, and it's sort of branched off into many of the ideas in modern mathematics just by trying to fix up these early proofs of Fermat's last theorem.
Right. Yes. And as a little bit of an aside, and a little bit we're gonna jump into the book and talk about it. But I've always been curious. Maybe you have an insight on this. Why is it that Fermat's last theorem was really a conjecture for some 300 plus years, right? Until Andrew Wiles, was it like in 1979, thereabouts? 95, okay, I'm sorry. Until 1995, it was unproven. It was a conjecture. Why have mathematicians always referred to it as Fermat's last theorem?
Well, I mean, I don't know, but the one reason might be that Fermat thought he had a proof of it. And, it's the famous legend that he said, I have a proof of this theorem, but it's too long to fit in the margin of my book. He was reading a copy of Diophantus. So for him, it was a theorem because he thought he had a proof. And that might be the genesis of the name.
Okay. Yeah, I've always been curious about that. One argument I read is it was, a way of honoring Fermat.
Well,
saying,
that could be
yes, we'll call this a theorem. And God, we hope it really is.
Right. I think for him it was, but nobody really knows.
Right. I mean, what I have read is that it's unlikely that he had a proof, and certainly the very sophisticated machinery that Andrew Wiles used would not have been at all available to Fermat or to anybody in his time. I mean, that's my sense of it.
Sure. And it's also likely, although nobody knows this for sure, that the proof that he had in mind that the flaw in the proof had to do with the lack of unique factorization in these rings of cyclotomic integers, although he didn't think of it that way.
Okay.
So it's the same flaw that, was in the proofs that came after that, that people thought that they had a proof, and then it turned out that there was a flaw in the proof, and the flaw always came down to the fact that certain rings don't have unique factorization.
Okay. Yeah, to me, it's always been a little bit unsettling that yes, there is a proof of Fermat's last theorem, but, are there more than a handful of people on the planet that can actually verify that proof? And can anybody verify all of it?
Yeah. Yeah, Glenn Stevens and another mathematician, Gary Cornell, organized a conference right after the proof was announced, a week-long conference at BU. And they tried, and every over the course of the week, they did work through the proof and tried to give the main ideas of it. But it was really heavy going. I have to say, I didn't understand a lot of it.
Yeah. I haven't tried, and I'm sure I wouldn't. I don't have the background. I suppose at age 50, if I started now and spent the rest of my life, I might be able to follow it, but I wouldn't bet on it.
There are some nice expository articles. I don't have them at my fingertips, but there are some nice expository articles that try to get at the main ideas of the proof. One is by this guy, John Stilwell from Australia, and it was in the Monthly, the American Mathematical Monthly. I can find the reference and send it to you. And what we tried to do in the book was to give a sense for what the early attempts looked like and give a rather complete description of the proof for exponent 3. And 4. Fermat actually proved it for 4. In, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's a relatively elementary proof.
Right.
But for 3, even for exponent 3, it turns out to be there are these technical pieces. You can understand the major idea. And you could also understand the technical pieces, but the technical pieces are rather technical.
Sure. Okay, so now that we've sort of dipped our toe in the waters of what the book is about, tell our listeners what is the book about and who is the audience?
Okay, so I think I tell a little bit about the history that, that Joe and I decided to work on an abstract algebra book that would be aimed at the audience of pre-service and practicing teachers, but also would be, I've always felt this, that an algebra course that took into account the needs of pre-service teachers would actually be a good undergraduate algebra course for all majors. So that's what we wanted to do. And we wanted to, in addition to the content, which is kind of at the intersection of algebra, geometry, and number theory, we wanted to show the power of abstraction and try to make it seem natural, because that's, you know, these abstract ideas like ring, for example, emerged from concrete experience, and we wanted to try to paint that picture and give people that experience. Let's see, the original design, which we carried through the end, first of all, we decided we did not want to start with group theory, the way a lot of abstract algebra courses do, because group theory is pretty remote from pre-service teachers' experience, and also pretty remote from high school mathematics. I mean, there are some examples of groups in high school mathematics, but they're not really faithful to what the idea is used, how the idea is used in real mathematics. So groups were going to come near the end in the historical setting of Galois, using them to solve algebraic equations. We were going to try to make focus on the structural similarities between integers and polynomials, because those are very close to people's experience. I mean, if you think about it, middle school is about integers and high school is about polynomials. That's an overgeneralization, but those are sort of the key objects. And we also wanted to, this is from my own high school teaching experience, I found ideas from abstract algebra extremely useful in my own profession, but they were never made explicit in any of the books. So we wanted to have these connection sections that made direct connections between the mathematics in the text and the mathematics the teachers would use in their profession. Things like, an analysis, just for background purposes, an analysis of the periods of repeating decimals, how you can tell how 1 over n, what the decimal expansion is going to look like just by the prime factorization of n.
Yep, I love that section. Yep, I have experimented with that on my own. So, yeah, I love that connection section.
Yeah, that was, I mean, and I've used that in workshops with teachers, and they just really love it because it ties up so much of the mathematics that they already use. Another connection we wanted to make was what I call applied mathematics. We wanted to show how abstract algebra could be used, applied to the kinds of things teachers do in their profession. So one of my favorite sections in the book that I've used for a long time is how to use, norms from quadratic fields or rational points on conics to make up problems for your high school kids that come out nice. Like, how do you find a cubic polynomial that has integer zeros and integer extrema? Or how do you find a scalene triangle with integer sides that has a 60-degree angle, for example? These are all kinds of problems that have cooked up in teachers' rooms around the country. But it turns out that abstract algebra provides the tools that you need to be able to develop these kinds of problems in a coherent way. So we wanted to make those connections explicit throughout the book, and we tried to do that. Another of my favorites is this connection between all over high school and middle school mathematics these days is find a rule that agrees with this table of data. And they usually, linear functions or quadratic functions or those kinds of things.
Right.
But there's a coherent theory. There's a couple coherent theories about how to do that, how to find a polynomial of lowest degree that agrees with a table of data, and it's Lagrange interpolation. Well, there's also another problem that shows up all over middle and high school mathematics that has to do with, the remainder when I divide my age by 5 is 3, and when I divide it by 7, it's 2, and when I divide it by 11, it's 1. How old am I? Those kinds of things. That's the Chinese remainder theorem.
Chinese remainder theorem, yep.
Yeah, well, it turns out that those two theorems are the same theorem. Lagrange interpolation and the Chinese remainder theorem are the same thing. It's just they're in different rings. So you change the spectrum, you change the ring, and even the proof goes through. So we tried to make that, we have in one of the connection section, why Lagrange interpolation is the same thing as the Chinese remainder theorem. And so there are other things like that. I'm sure if you've looked through the book, you've seen some of those things. But the idea was to delay group theory to show how it actually showed up near the end of the book, to make explicit connections to the mathematics that teachers use in their profession, and also to develop a text that was more exploratory than didactic, so that ideas are previewed in problem sets before they're brought to closure in the text itself.
Okay, so one of the audiences for the book are high school teachers, but obviously another audience are high school students. Yes?
Well, in the connection sections, I mean, some of this mathematics has been used with high school students, but really what we intended was to make this an undergraduate text. Our graduate text for professional development for practicing teachers. So we didn't have high school students in mind exactly, but some of the mathematics, for example, there's a section in there on cryptography, has been used with high school students and has been quite successful. I used to use, in our high school algebra text, for example, we do Lagrange interpolation and try just in a very, very elementary way to make the connection between it and the Chinese remainder theorem. So yeah, these ideas do show up in high school. But our primary audience were teachers and people preparing to be teachers.
Right. I wish that I had learned this stuff in the normal high school curriculum as opposed to going off for the summer and having gotten it in a very condensed and intense way, because this way of thinking of, open-ended exploration and rigorous thinking and proofs and salvaging proofs and everything you've got in your book, boy, I wish that high school students got some serious exposure to that, because it's a very different way of looking at mathematics than the drill and kill and all these other techniques that just get kids to walk away from this stuff and saying it's not relevant, it's not meaningful, it's not fun.
Right, exactly. Yep. I mean, we tried to do that in our high school CME project, and there are middle school curricula like that we've developed too, but they're not as widespread as the mainstream commercial text that you're talking about. You're right.
Yeah, okay. And I'm also interested, this is going to be a naive question, but I'll put myself on the spot and ask, what do you see as the difference between modern algebra and number theory? Because when you and I were talking on the phone, whenever it was, a month or two ago, before setting up this interview, I said, "Oh, this is a great number theory book." And then you reminded me, it's like, no, this is an algebra book. And I'm going, "Oh yeah, that's right." But there's so much that they have in common.
That's right. I mean, a lot of that has to do with the fact that we decided to start out with integers. So number theory is about sort of the arithmetic properties, starts out with the arithmetic properties of integers, very much like in the Ross problem sets. Where abstract algebra picks up, I think, is when you make the abstractions to reasoning about the structure of systems rather than about the structures of individual systems. So talking about the properties of rings, for example, where you're not talking about any particular ring, so that when you prove a theorem about rings, you prove it for every particular ring, like integers or polynomials or matrices or anything like that. So I think that maybe I'm wrong, and Joe might even disagree with me, but I think that the difference is that that abstract algebra is about the structural properties of algebraic systems, like rings and fields and algebras and those kinds of things. Whereas number theory seems to me to be a lot more applied. Those ideas are applied to specific systems, like rings of polynomials or rings of integers and those kinds of things, roots of unity and so forth.
Okay, but okay.
But it's a fuzzy line. And when we've given talks about the book, lots of people say that the first two or three chapters are what we cover in our number theory course.
Right, and I would certainly say there's a tremendous amount of number theory in Fermat's Last Theorem.
Absolutely. Right.
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
But the arithmetic, the number theory itself, That's a good example, because the number theory itself is about arithmetic, but it's about arithmetic, at least in the book, the way we cover these proofs, it's about arithmetic in rings of cyclotomic integers rather than ordinary integers. So we do a lot with Gaussian integers and what we call Eisenstein integers, and then rings of roots of unity and that kind of thing. It's number theory, but it's number theory in different systems.
Okay, all right. And you know, and I also wanted to make the point that may not be obvious to to a lot of folks, but there is something very special about number theory, modern algebra, whatever you want to call it, that makes it accessible to bright students who don't have a deep background in mathematics. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think it's not just bright students. I think it's about everyone. In my own high school teaching, I taught all kinds of classes, and what you just said is true, I think, for just about everyone. Excuse me. And one of the reasons, or a couple of reasons, one is that number theory and algebra are examples of what we call low threshold, high ceiling. Anybody can get started. You don't need much of a background. You know, if you can count, you can start thinking about adding integers and primes and those kinds of things. But yet, you quickly get into deep water, so it's got stuff that will challenge the most advanced students. There are other things like that, by the way, besides number theory and algebra, like combinatorics or geometry. But number theory and algebra are good examples of this easy entry, and then you can push it pretty far. The other thing I like about number theory and algebra is that it's constructive in the sense that insights can emerge from numerical experiments, our algebraic experiments. So in our high school program, we ask kids, for example, which integers are a difference of two squares? Or even more difficult, which integers are a sum of two squares? That's open to experiment, right? I mean, you can start doing computations, and you can make tables, and you can look for regularity in the data and that kind of thing. Or another example that we use with a computer algebra system is take the polynomials x squared minus 1, x cubed minus 1, x to the fourth minus 1, and so forth, x to the n minus 1, and factor them over the integers. And how does the number of factors, the number of irreducible factors over the integers, vary as a function of the exponent? So, you know, x squared minus 1 has two factors, x cubed minus 1 also has two factors, x to the fourth minus 1 has three factors, and so forth. These are things you can experiment with, and you don't need any background at all to sort of start gathering data and doing computation.
Yes, this is great. This reminds me of every now and then I'll run into some interesting, math problem, usually a famous unsolved math problem that is simple enough for a child to start to experiment with, but hard enough that professional mathematicians can't solve it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, even in this question of repeating decimals, for example, there are unsolved problems. Like, no one knows if there are infinitely many primes for which the decimal expansion is as big as it can possibly be. That's a famous, I think it goes back to Gauss, even.
Oh, wow, okay. Wasn't aware of that one, okay.
And then there's also, there's just the elegance and delight of the results. And I'm thinking, for example, like this thing we just talked about, the structural similarity between Lagrange interpolation and the Chinese remainder theorem. That's just something that grabs you. Or I remember back in, I think I read this in Weil's algebraic number theory book, that, for example, the way a prime decomposes in the Gaussian integers is directly parallel to the way x squared plus 1 factors modulo that prime.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's the same and it's the same thing for other rings as well. The way a prime factors in the roots in the ring of cube roots of unity is directly connected to how x squared plus x plus 1 factors modulo that prime. So you end up with these beautiful sort of previews of deep theories like class field theory that you can just sort of begin to see by doing numerical experiments. And when you do see them, I remember that one in particular just blew me away when I first saw it. That the decomposition of a prime in a field that contains the root of a polynomial is connected to how that polynomial factors modulo that prime.
Yes, that does sound kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's really gorgeous.
So related to that, let me ask you this question. When I was at the Ross program, Professor Ross very much discouraged people from going to the computer center to do anything, probably because he figured, and I'm sure he was right, that we would all play computer games. Now, this was in the late 70s, early 80s. The computer center had, teletypes, and it probably even had punch cards at that point. So we were not playing video games. If anything, we were playing Adventure or, some very text-based game that's, boring to most kids by anybody's standards today. But
Sure.
what I'm curious about is, and I suppose there were computer algebra systems back then. There were things like Maxima,
Right.
back then, and now we have Mathematica and the open source Sage software and a number of other
Oh
systems.
yeah, I mean they exist on handhelds, on calculators, computer algebra systems.
Right. Yes, that's right. But what I'm curious about, and hey, maybe there's another book in this for you, is I have not seen anybody talk before you about the idea of using a computer algebra system. And I worked for Wolfram Research for very short stint a few years back. Actually worked for Conrad Wolfram, one of the founders, for his computer-based math.org
I see.
project. And so I got a fair amount of exposure to Mathematica. And I'm curious about the possibility of students using these CAS tools to do investigation of things that would be very onerous to do by hand. At some point, factoring polynomials just gets really tedious. And but so, has anybody done, a book that guides students in exploration of these questions with computers?
Well, yes and no. I mean, let's see. First of all, in Promise, there's actually a difference between how the teachers work and how the kids work. The kids don't use calculators or computers for the most part, although some of them do in their advanced research projects. You know, Glenn has this saying, "Don't let the calculator have all the fun." There's a lot to be gained. There's a lot to be gained from sort of feeling in your gut the result of hand calculations. That's eased a bit with the teachers. The teachers do use calculators and sometimes use computer algebra systems. That's just because it's become so much a part of what they do. You know, they're just so used to using these kind of technological tools. So there's that. Back in 1990, I wrote a book published by MIT Press called Investigations in Algebra that actually used the Logo programming language to investigate some topics in number theory and algebra for high school students. It actually came from the work that I did with some kids at my high school. We were in high school in Massachusetts, in a course that we called Independent Study. So they would build computational models of mathematical objects. In our high school series, we do use computer algebra systems and calculators and dynamic geometry environments and so forth. And then we have to make sure that we, because this technology is not so widely available, we have to, you know, provide unplugged teacher notes so the teachers can use these things, for example, with a spreadsheet rather than with a CAS. It's not necessary to use it, but it certainly is an enhancement. Like, for example, when we do Lagrange interpolation in Algebra 2, you don't want to do, you know, if you know what Lagrange interpolation is, you have this product of all these binomial factors, and multiplying them up by hand doesn't tell you much. So what you want to do is remove the computational overhead. The way we think about it at EDC, anyway, is that we use this kind of technology, especially CAS systems, to certainly reduce computational overhead when you need to, but also to perform experiments with algebraic objects the way you'd use a calculator to experiment with numbers. So, for example, the good example is this: how many factors does x to the n minus 1 have over the integers? You want to generate a lot of data for that first before you start to make conjectures, and a CAS is ideal for that. And then the other thing that we use the CIS for is to build computational models of algebraic objects that have no faithful physical counterpart. I'm thinking, for example, in the abstract algebra book with Joe, we spend a lot of time going over the basic idea that that you can construct a field in which a polynomial has a root by taking the coefficient field and reducing modulo that polynomial. So in simple terms, you can construct the complex numbers by taking polynomials with real coefficients and reducing them modulo x squared plus 1. That's a tough idea, and it's usually considered intractable for high school kids and for many undergraduates. But you can build a computational model of that system. Just like I can build a computational model of the integers mod n, I can build a computational model of polynomials with real coefficients, modulo x squared plus 1, and lo and behold, it acts just like the complex numbers. So you sort of built the complex numbers the way you'd build a model in a physics lab, except you're building it on a computer. That's a long-winded answer to say that, yes, there are lots of examples. There's a whole group of high school teachers and undergraduate faculty in the Chicago area that runs a conference every year called, I forget the exact name of it, but it's something to do with computer algebra systems. And they talk about how they're using computer algebra systems in high school and undergraduate mathematics. Sorry, that's a long-winded answer.
Oh, I'm soaking it up. I'm really loving it. My only little piece of response here is that Glenn Stevens, I'm still a little bit curious as to why he really shuns away from letting students use, you know, computer algebra systems at all. I mean, the way I think about it is, you know, if you gave me 2 5-digit numbers to multiply together, it's like I know that algorithm really well. I could do it just fine, but why bother? You know, at some point, once you have developed a certain amount of grounding in whatever the objects are that you are manipulating and the system that you're trying to understand, you know, once you're good enough at multiplying those 5-digit numbers, I think there does come the point where you say, why bother?
Well, yeah, I what I'm about to say, I'm pretty sure Glenn would agree with. If the point of a calculation is to get a numerical answer to a numerical problem, then all tools are good, including calculators and computers. But if the point of a numerical calculation is to lead you to some insight about the structure of the underlying system, then the calculator can get in the way. So a good example is I want to figure out the period of the repeating decimal for 1/7. So one way to do that is to use long division and divide 7 into 1. Now, I can certainly type 1/7 into a calculator or a CAS and get the decimal expansion. And if I do that enough times for different denominators, I can probably figure out that there's some regularity here, and I can maybe even come up with some conjectures. But the hand calculation actually helps you understand why those conjectures are true. That you're going to start a repeat when you get a remainder of 1 again. And if you do that out, you'll see that you're going to get a remainder of 1 when you have a power of 10 that leaves a remainder of 1 mod 7, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
okay,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say that is actually a really excellent example. And you start thinking about the fact that, well, 7 is a prime, and, you know, why are you, you know, why is there a cycle of 7,
right,
and things like that, that you're not going to get any insight at all with the calculator.
Yeah, that's right. So if the point is to get a numerical answer to a numerical problem, then sure, there's no sense in slugging it all out. But if the point is to get some insight into what's actually going on, then I think the hand calculation can help you do that better than just gathering data with the technology. Now, there are people who are going to disagree with that. They're saying, well, why not just generate lots and lots of examples, look at the data, make some conjectures, and then go back and see if you can prove them. That just seems inefficient to me, where the insight can actually lie in the calculations themselves.
It's a very different way of, I think, of relating to mathematics. Yes, I mean, I agree. If you use a computer to get a pile of data and then go back and do the mathematics, it wouldn't give me the same thrill of getting that aha moment. by looking at a small amount of data by hand.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see the result actually emerge in front of your eyes. And if you're habituated to looking for that kind of thing, by the way, that's the other thing. There's a difference between, you know, I've seen kids who can work a page of adding and subtracting fractions and then walk away and have learned nothing. But that's different from taking a look at an orchestrated sequence of calculations and being in the habit of looking for some regularity in what you're doing. Not just regularity in the data, but regularity in the process itself.
Yes. Yep. So I am curious. Do you think that there is hope? Maybe you can help to, you know, create a movement of taking the principles that are in this learning modern algebra book and bringing them into high school, but ideally even into middle school, you know, things like rigorous thinking and making connections to relevant things and thinking about open-ended problems and podoscips and all of these things, all of the secret sauce that makes this book. I would love to see this in middle schools and high schools. It's not
it's there in pockets. So I like to think that we've created middle school and high school programs, the CME project, and we have another curriculum for middle school called Transition to Algebra, that do exactly that. That we have the design principles like experience before formality and textured emphasis so that you really emphasize, you de-emphasize convention and emphasize substance. There's a whole list of things like that that are in the design of it. And I also have some high hope because the Common Core State Standards is calling for exactly this kind of thing. They have the goals for understanding rather than just goals for performance. And they have these standards, what they call the standards for mathematical practice. There are 8 standards that help kids develop. That if kids meet these standards, there are things like making use of structure, or seeking regularity in repeated actions, or, you know, using tools strategically, those kinds of things. That if kids actually meet those standards, they'll have developed the habits of mind of a proficient user of mathematics. So I think that there is hope, and there are certainly pockets of teachers around the country who are dedicated to developing this kind of thing. One of the best examples is, do you know about Math for America?
I have heard of it, but I don't know anything about it. Tell me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's started in New York, and it's still, that's the biggest installation. It's a community of teachers who are dedicated to, you know, becoming lifelong learners of mathematics and to developing programs for their kids that that do exactly the kinds of things that you're talking about, that develop mathematical ways of thinking and that stress reasoning and that define expertise as what you can figure out rather than what you know, those kinds of things. And this, you know, there's several hundred teachers in New York. We have a Math for America in Boston. There's a Math for America in L.A. And the basic idea here is that we want to professionalize pre-college teaching in a way that puts teachers in charge of their own professional development and helps teachers develop the kinds of thinking in their kids that you're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, I...
Oh, yes.
Yes. I mean,
There's hope.
Good, good. And, you know, and I love this conversation because the point that you just made is not obvious, I think, to a lot of people, although it sounds real obvious to say it, is math is really a way of thinking. You know, kids go into school and they're told to do arithmetic, you know, and then, you know, algebra, trigonometry, maybe pre-calculus or whatever. But I wonder how many kids really, really get at a deep level that it really is about a way of thinking. And once you have a particular way of thinking, you can approach all different branches of mathematics and have success in them because you've got a framework for creating structures, understanding the material, doing proofs, thinking rigorously, that sort of thing.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, I know that you always ask people if they have any ideas about why kids, what advice to give to parents if they struggle in mathematics. What you just said, I think, is the best advice that you could give people, is that rather than worrying about mastering specific things one by one as if they were all different. Develop these mathematical habits of mind that will allow you to approach all kinds of problems and that are really general purpose and will serve you. And there's certainly, you don't have to master all this mass of individual facts. You can master a few general purpose tools, and that'll help you figure things out if you don't have them memorized.
Well, all right, so let me push you a little bit on to go further with that answer. If the parent isn't fortunate enough to have their student be in one of the programs that you're involved with, how do they help their kid to develop those habits of mind?
Well, yeah. I mean,
there's a next book.
I would. I mean, I try to look for the roots of the struggle. There are these kind of common notions that kids struggle with mathematics because, for example, they're not fluent in basic arithmetic, and there's something to that. And there's this notion that kids struggle in mathematics because school mathematics is, you know, all about memorization and meaningless formulas and those kinds of, and there's something to that too. But I do think that it's more nuanced than that. It has to do with what the whole game is about, and that it's about figuring things out rather than amassing facts. Like for example, the argument that it's all about practicing calculations. And so you can learn an awful lot by practicing calculations and by practicing with formulas. An example that I use all the time is, you know, there's this algorithm for figuring out how many positive factors a positive integer has. You factor it into prime powers, you add one to each of the exponents, and you multiply them together, and that's how many positive factors it has.
Well, that's the phi formula, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I found it most effective to not explain why that's true at all. Just start with it and have people practice it a bit. And then they begin to see, by doing the hand calculations in this case, why that has to be true. So that the meaning, I think Wittgenstein said that the meaning evolves from the use. And so it's not just as black and white that practicing and doing orchestrated calculations, those can lead to lots of insight. So it's not as simple as simply eliminating all the practice and all the calculations. And it's also true that, for example, there are kids who are fluent in calculations and still struggle with algebra and still struggle with geometry and those kinds of things. So there's no easy answer. I think, for example, I have two colleagues at EDC, Paul Goldenberg and Drew Mark, are working on a program that they call Transition to Algebra that helps kids realize that they have it in their heads already, the ability to figure things out. And they do it not through standard middle school mathematics. They do it through puzzles and games and those kinds of things, very, very carefully chosen so that it helps kids do things like build abstraction and look for regularity in data. As far as advice to give to parents, I think the thing to do is to look for things like this and to try to help your child understand that he or she really does have what it takes to succeed in mathematics, but they just have to step back and try to make sense of what it is rather than trying to sort of just get through it.
Okay. All right. I mean, I'll take that. It's a good thing. I mean, that I'm left uneasy with your answer, but it's a good thing because I think it means that there's more for all of us to explore about how to get there. And maybe there's another book.
What makes you uneasy about it?
Is if I were a parent, I don't know what I would do what I would concretely do to help my child to develop these habits of mind.
I see. I mean, it sounds like it's not an easy thing to do, but I would get involved in the school's choice of curricula and make sure that I'm trying to help them choose, adopt something that helps kids develop these habits of mind. I would invest more in teacher professional development so the teachers can develop this kind of thinking for themselves. and, you know, pressure the school committees and so forth to put money into professional development and supporting teachers in their profession rather than piling on the tests and trying to weed out what they call the teachers whose kids aren't performing.
Okay.
I think most teachers really want teachers really want their kids to succeed, and with the right tools, they can do it. But the resources have to be there, and the resources, especially in terms of supporting teachers in their own mathematical learning.
Right. Okay. And can you think of any ways that a parent could work one-on-one with a child, or let's say a homeschooling parent, if, you know, what kinds of projects could a parent take on with their child that would help them to think mathematically? That's what I'm getting at, is it's like,
right,
they can lobby in their schools, they can get involved with curriculum development, but it's going to be, you know, very, very few parents that will go that far. So what can the masses do?
To work individually with their kids.
Yes.
I'm thinking that what's, and, you know, I don't have these things at my fingertips except for the ones that we produce at EDC, to look for resources that they can use that contain projects. So, I mean, here is an example. We have a website called Making Mathematics. And I hate to keep pushing the stuff that we do at work, but we have a website called Making Mathematics that contains, a collection of projects for kids to work on. They're not the kind of thing you can finish in an hour. They're the kind of thing that, you know, originally these were designed to be collaborations between mathematicians and high school kids who would work together online to work on some of these projects. So one of them has to do with this famous combinatorial problem of a simplex lock. How many combinations are there on a simplex lock, which is one of these locks you see a lot in dormitories and airports. It's got five buttons, and there's some rules that go with it. Mm-hmm. Another, there's a probability problem. What's the probability that if I pick two integers at random, they have no common factor, that kind of thing.
That's a great problem, yes.
Yeah, so the projects are posted on the website. The hints are posted on the website. There are solutions where we have them posted on the website. And there are notes for teachers, or in this case, parents, about how to approach these kinds of things. There are resources like that. I'm just not saying that they're unique to EDC. There are resources like that all over the country that parents should look for, that they can work with their kids. I guess what I'm saying is it's not so much remediation as it is to sort of jump-starting their ability to think in mathematical ways.
Right, and the way I look at it is if these problems are challenging enough and they're the kinds of problems where the parent probably only needs to be one step ahead of the child.
Yeah, or even on the same page as the child,
or
they can do it
perfect.
Together.
Or even on the same page, the same level, then they can work on the exploration together. And, you know, that's a novel thing. I've never talked to anyone on this podcast series, you know, who gave the idea of, hey, you know, how about if the parent is not more advanced than the child and they literally are sitting at the kitchen table together.
Trying to figure things out, yep.
Yeah, trying to figure things out, you know, isn't that a different model of doing math than, you know, the tutor-student or, you know, all of the models where, you know, the teacher knows everything and opens up the student's head and pours in the knowledge.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's actually much more faithful to the way mathematics is really done. Think, for example, of people studying for a PhD in mathematics and they're working with their advisors. Lots of times it's just a collaborative effort. They're trying to figure things out together. So it's really the way things are done.
That's right, but we don't think about it that way, certainly not in the, you know, in the less advanced, you know, in primary school, secondary school, that level, we don't think of math as this collaborative effort. You know, maybe the internet will make it more and more so. But I love the idea of people getting together either virtually or physically at the kitchen table and saying, What do you think of this problem? And just bouncing ideas and doing it collaboratively. Now,
Yeah.
does the
Go ahead.
Promise program allow or encourage kids to work together on problems? I can't remember if the ROS program encouraged that or sort of funneled kids into spending a bunch of time working on these problems on their own.
I think it does both. I mean, I can tell you what happens with the teachers, because that's where I spend most of my time in this hour. The teachers sit together at tables of maybe 5 to 7 teachers, and it's not stylized group work where everybody has to share everything that pops into their head. What people usually do is they work on things on their own for a while, and I think that's really important to let things percolate. And then they try to explain what it is that they're struggling with or what it is they understand to someone else. And then a discussion starts to happen, and you can actually see ideas evolving through the collaboration. It's like I try to explain something to you, but I don't really understand what I'm saying. It's kind of half-baked, so you pick at it and try to get me to be more precise. And between the two of us, we start to come up with some kind of an insight. That kind of thing, I think, is a really good skill for teachers to have, because that's what happens in classrooms all the time, that kids come up with half-baked ideas that contain a germ of something important. And a real skill in teaching mathematics is to be able to pick at that and sort of capitalize on what the kid is trying to say and make it more precise. So that happens a lot in the Promise for Teachers program. So there's group work of that kind where they're sort of using each other to kind of fine-tune their own ideas.
Yeah, and as maybe I'm getting a little philosophical here, but I think as a human species, we are social creatures, and there is something very powerful about, the sum is greater than, the whole is greater than the parts, and that kind of thing, the sum of the parts kind of thing. There is something magical about people getting together, tribes of like-minded people getting together to do mathematics.
Right, that's right. But I mean, we don't want to turn it into a stylized cartoon of what you of that insight, so that there are some proponents of group work that have people just never working by themselves, just always talking to other people and trying to come up with the ideas. And I find that really frustrating. I think in the a lot of mathematics is done alone, and then you come together with other people to try to explain what it is you're trying to do, or explain what it is you've discovered, or help ask for help to kind of fine-tune what it is you're trying your insight. So it's not a stylized thing where everything has to be done in a group, especially in mathematics, where a lot of it has to be done alone before you can trot it out for public comment.
Yes, I agree. Thinking of my own experience in solving math problems, and I have led some math circles, if the first time I ever thought about a problem was in a math circle, it would not be the same as having ruminated on it on my own for a good, for however long it took, and then come to the
Absolutely,
math
right.
circle and try to refine the ideas. I completely agree.
Yeah. And so that's what we try to do in Promise for Teachers, and that's what we try to do in our curriculum as well.
Very good. So we're getting ready to wind down here, but I do want to ask you a couple of more questions before I let you go. One thing that we didn't talk about your book is the historical thread that runs through the book, right? The early attempts to prove Fermat's last theorem. What is your sense of the importance of history in mathematics?
Well, I mean, they're the obvious things that it shows that it's an evolving discipline that people struggled with for a long time, and it shows how, for example, in the early attempts to prove Fermat's last theorem, people built off of each other's ideas and tried to refine the flaws in the proofs. I think that's an important message, especially for people who are studying to be teachers, that these ideas don't just sort of drop out of the blue already made. They evolve and they are gradually refined over time. But then there are also, well, for example, there's this folklore in high school that the complex numbers were invented to find a number whose square root is minus 1. And that's simply just not the way it happened. Complex numbers evolved as tools to solve cubic equations. And it's one of these things where they came up with a method for solving cubic equations that involves taking square roots of negative numbers. But in the end, those square roots of negative numbers went away. So you can have a cubic equation with real roots like 1, 2, and 5. And in applying their algorithm, you had to take square roots of negative numbers to come up with those roots. And in fact, those so-called imaginary quantities went away in the end. That's a really important piece of background for teachers. Not that they want to present exactly what I just said to their kids, but at least they can give a somewhat historically faithful idea of why it took so long for people to understand what complex numbers were and to represent them geometrically and those kinds of things. So you can ask kids, you can try to develop questions for kids that will lead them to this idea that sometimes if you make believe something exists, you can use it as a tool to get a solution, and then it goes away in the end and you're back to where you were in the real world. I think Hadamard said that the shortest path between two problems and the real numbers passes through the complex domain.
So that, you know, I had never heard that explanation of the complex numbers. That's a very sort of subtle, abstract point that you can develop something to help you to solve a problem, and then at the end that thing goes away.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to show up, though, quite a bit. So, for example, even for little kids, I can imagine, I can't think of one off the top of my head, a problem that I state in whole numbers and that has an answer in whole numbers, but to get to that answer, I have to use something equivalent to fractions. So I go up, do this thing with these strange creatures, and then they go away in the end. And it's exactly the same with solving cubic equations, that you have a method for solving them that's going to produce the roots, but along the way you have to sort of hold your nose and deal with these imaginary quantities, and then they disappear. I think that there are other examples of that. I can't think of any right now, but that to me is a really valuable story for teachers to understand. It was certainly valuable in my own teaching. It changed the way I thought about complex numbers, and made it seem to the kids less arbitrary. You know, why would you want to solve x squared plus 1 equals 0 if it doesn't exist in the first place?
You know, that you have me very intrigued. I'm going to go on to, like, math, I think, Stack Overflow. You know, there's a whole community of these Stack Overflow sites. And I think there's a Math Overflow site where people ask and answer interesting math questions. I think I'm going to throw the question out there, giving your example of the you know, using complex numbers to solve, you know, to find roots of cubic equations, and see if people can come up with other examples of these intermediate things that you have to work with that then go away.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to do. Yep.
It's another one of these mind-blowing ideas, because, you know, I've never ever considered, you know, the role of complex numbers in such a way that they're interesting. Okay, all right. You've given me a lot to think about.
Yeah, I have to say that in the book with Joe, that was one of the things that we worked on the hardest. That whole section on Renaissance mathematics and the emergence of complex numbers. We were really trying to do a good job conveying the spirit of what actually happened.
Okay, well, I'm gonna go find that section in your book, and I'm gonna quote a little piece of it for Math Overflow and see if I can get a discussion going. I think it'll be a fascinating discussion.
Oh, I'd love to hear what happens too. Please let me know.
Yeah, I'll send you a link to it once I get it going. So this has been a delightful interview, and so the last question I have for you, I mean, you've already asked the last question about advice to give a child, so I'm not going to ask that one again, but is there a next book or project for you?
Well, there are certain kind of things in the back of our mind. Let's see. Joe and I, Joe is giving, or just finished giving, a series of lectures, some of which were taken from the book, to a group of senior citizens at the University of Illinois. And we're thinking of, he's thinking of putting putting that together in a book, and we might work on it together. So that's one thing. Another thing is, back in 1972, I think, I took a course, it was at Bowdoin, from the late Ken Ireland, who wrote absolutely one of the most beautiful books in algebra and number theory that I've ever seen. And it was a course basically of what Ken's idea was, to take the things that live in the folklore of high school mathematics, like you can't trisect a 60-degree angle with a straight-edge and compass, or the fundamental theorem of algebra, or the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, or any of the you know, that there's no solution to the quintic equation with radicals. And the course that he laid out over the course of 6 weeks was to develop the mathematics you needed to understand that. E is transcendental was another one. I've got the notes from that, and I've been in touch over the years with his wife, and I would like to turn that into a book sometime, because I think that would be a really useful, another useful resource for people who are teachers. So those are two books in the works. In terms of projects, my colleagues and I are just finishing up a linear algebra course for high school kids, which I'm really pleased with. It's the development of, my colleagues and I at the high school where I taught a linear algebra course to high school kids for 20 years, and I'm convinced that it's a high school course even more so than calculus. So we're in the midst of putting the final touches on that. That's one project. And let's see. Glenn and I are thinking, we're always working on sort of building on the idea of Promise for Teachers. So the next thing that we're thinking about doing is, there are these projects around the country, like the Park City Math Institute that has a course every summer for teachers that's actually designed by the alumni of the Promise program. There's the Math for America seminars that are running around the country. There's Promise for Teachers. There's all kinds of things that are sort of co-designed with teachers to develop the mathematics that they use in their professions. And I'd really like to develop something along the lines of a more formal graduate program for teachers that's co-designed with teachers and that treats the kind of mathematics that falls through the cracks in both mathematics departments and in teacher education courses. So those things are enough to keep going for a while.
Yes, I think you are going to have enough to keep going for a while, absolutely. Well, it has been absolutely delightful to have this phone conversation with you. I really appreciate your time, your passion, the contributions you're making to teachers and to students and to changing the way that we all think about mathematics, the habits of mind that you talk about. I think it's all great.
That's great. I've enjoyed this a lot. Thank you.
Yes.
I haven't talked too much.
No. This has been great. If you can talk 10 times more than I do, then I'm always very happy. So there you have it, folks. Al Cuoco, inspired by math.